A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I mentioned for the 100th time on this podcast, but really because I think that this is a puzzle that I chip away at now and again. And right now I'm on a track that I'm trying to eat a bit more healthily and regularly throughout the day, making sure I don't skip any meals. And I mentioned that my particular health issue, I feel like I've mentioned all my health issues on this podcast at this point, is I had a gallbladder surgery 7 years ago and really have a hard time with sort of eating since. Get bloated really, really easily. But the thing that's definitely connected, that I can say without a doubt does make a big difference, is fat, which is, of course, the classical thing. If you don't have a gallbladder, we've talked about the physiology and biology at work here. You store up bile in order to process fat, and when you don't have it, it just drips down. It's kind of a horrible image. I just kind of picture like this leaking pipe in a dilapidated residential complex or something. I'm talking about your liver that dripped down bile into this storage reservoir, and when it's gone, it's just dripping into the small intestine. And that's a worthy topic of conversation in its own right, because from what I gather, there is beginning to be a decent amount of evidence linking what people often just discount it as, well, it's just fine, it just kind of harmlessly drips. But even from a non-medical standpoint, just doesn't sound right. You're like, wait, what do you mean? It kind of just harmlessly drips away into like your intestine. It doesn't sound like that is the ideal plumbing. But there is some evidence, I know, that that actually can trigger some kind of chronic inflammation. But for another day's topic. Those are the fundamental mechanics, so it makes sense why a big fatty meal, like eating a big pizza or a hamburger or essentially anything that tastes good, it's not gonna work as well as it did. Now the question is really, well, what goes wrong? And I think we can leave the listeners, spare them that detail, because I can certainly answer the question, but you know, people might be enjoying their breakfast. Gastrointestinal side effects, let's leave it at that. Here's what I'd like to actually ask. When we're looking at making dietary shifts, we talked about some of these before, you can't just say I'm going to cut out fat, because firstly, you can't really avoid fat. Secondly, you need some fat even on a fat restricted diet. Like, you have to have it. There's fat soluble nutrients you're just not going to get if you don't have fat. But here's where I think I struggle. If I'm out and about and I'm thinking, okay, what are my options here that I can eat that are less fatty and less likely, therefore, to trigger symptoms if I'm, I don't wish to think this way, but it's kind of become a reflex. Currently, I find one thing that really helps is smaller portion sizes. But if you're really, really hungry, you just need to eat. You know that kind of feeling, you're starving. You haven't, you're out and you're looking for food. You're not going to just have like a quarter of a baguette or something. So when we talk about food that's high in fat, we have to think about the amount and the fat content, because you've some things that are very, very high in fat. I'm going to state the obvious here, but that they're very high in fat, but you only have a small amount in each portion. And then you have things that are low in fat and you have a lot of them. So the total portion size is, I guess, what matters. But I looked into this stuff before, but I kind of feel like it'd be useful to have some parameters to judge what is a fatty meal, to the extent that maybe that's probably going to be too much. Let's take, for example, I go out and I order a really good hamburger. So think about, like, you know, a big generous portion of a hamburger. I'm not skimping on anything. I've got some condiments thrown in. Scenario two, I go for that same hamburger, but I deliberately avoid the condiments. Scenario three, this is what I try to do. I say, well, chicken is less fat, but it's still, you know, a hamburger or a burger served in one of those kind of fast food establishments. And I can't imagine they're going out of their way to minimize the fat content. Scenario four, anything else. Because I feel like if you have an idea that this is like, this would be, let's say, 60 grams of fat, and I know that that triggers me, versus you try eat half of it, you could maybe even work back. Now, I'm no one, including me, wants to be sitting there with a calculator measuring what they're eating, and I think we have to consider that in the context of what we recommend as well. But what would be helpful is a few things to kind of ground the, well, what's, how when we talk about a fat-restricted diet for dietary, for medical needs, nutritional needs, as in this case and some other groups, what are we talking about in terms of what's like a level that we can get fat intake down to that is not going to itself cause problems? And where do we go from there to actually breaking down into meals where we're going to get enough protein, we're going to get enough, you know, micronutrients? It's going to be a well-balanced diet, just much leaner on fat than maybe your average person might be consuming. I know that's a big ask, Carmen and Corin, but let's try to give some clarity to those like me who don't really, never thought, certainly before this operation, nutrition really wasn't something I thought about. I just kind of ate food. And we're looking at nutritional labels, and we're trying to understand what can we eat, what's going to give us the best nutrition for the least discomfort if we are struggling with these symptoms.
Daniel sent us this one, and he's been chipping away at this puzzle for a while now. He had gallbladder surgery 7 years ago, and since then, eating without getting bloated has been a real challenge. The core mechanics make sense. No gallbladder means no bile storage tank, just a slow drip from the liver into the small intestine, and big fatty meals become a problem. He's not asking us to rehash the biology, though. What he wants is practical. When we talk about a fat-restricted diet for someone in his situation, what level of fat intake are we actually targeting? Low enough to manage symptoms, but not so low. You're missing fat-soluble nutrients.
Before we get into the numbers, I should mention DeepSeek V4 Pro is handling the script today. So if anything comes out unusually coherent, that's why.
He wants some grounding parameters, so when he's out and hungry, staring at a menu, he can make a decent guess about what's going to work.
He's right that this is one of those things where the standard advice, just avoid fatty foods, is almost uselessly vague. Because you can't avoid fat entirely, and you shouldn't. By the way, quick note, today's episode script is coming from DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why. The fat passes through partially undigested, and that's where the gastrointestinal fireworks begin.
What's actually going to be manageable? He gave the example of a hamburger, full version with condiments, version without condiments, switching to a chicken burger, or going for something else entirely. He wants to know what ballpark of fat grams he's dealing with, so he can work backward from what he knows triggers him.
Let's start with the baseline numbers, because those actually give us something to anchor to. When clinicians talk about a fat-restricted diet for post-cholecystectomy patients, they're typically aiming for somewhere between 30 and 50 grams of fat per day total. That's not per meal, that's the whole day. For context, the average American diet is somewhere around 70 to 90 grams of fat daily, and plenty of people go well north of 100.
We're talking about roughly cutting the average intake in half, maybe more. But 30 grams, what does that actually look like spread across a day?
It's tight. If you're doing 3 meals, you're looking at maybe 8 to 12 grams per meal, with a little wiggle room for a snack. And here's the thing Daniel pointed out that's really important. The threshold for triggering symptoms varies person to person. Some people can handle 15 grams in a single meal. Others start having issues at 8 or 10 grams.
All right, so let's get practical. Daniel wants numbers. He wants to know what a fat-restricted diet actually means in grams per day, and then how that translates into real-world meals where you're not pulling out a calculator at the drive-thru.
Let's ground this in clinical guidelines. The standard definition of a low-fat diet is typically less than 30% of total calories from fat. For someone eating 2,000 calories a day, that's about 65 grams of fat. It is, and he's not wrong that there's emerging evidence this constant drip isn't as harmless as doctors used to assume. There's research suggesting that continuous bile exposure to the intestinal lining can contribute to chronic low-grade inflammation and changes in the gut microbiome.
Daniel asked, what's the minimum before you start causing problems?
This is crucial. You cannot go below about 15 to 20 grams per day without risking essential fatty acid deficiency. Your body needs linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid. These are essential, meaning you can't synthesize them. Let's break it down. A standard fast food quarter-pound beef patty, before cheese, before condiments, before the bun, is running about 20 to 25 grams of fat all by itself. That's already close to a full day's budget on a 30-gram target. Add a slice of cheese, that's another 5 to 9 grams. A tablespoon of mayonnaise is about 10 grams of fat. The bun itself usually adds another 2 to 3 grams.
We've got a window, somewhere between 20 grams and about 50 grams daily. Below 20, you're courting nutritional deficiencies. Above 50, for someone like Daniel, you're probably in symptom territory. And that's not a huge window.
It's not. Which is why the meal composition matters so much. Let's take Daniel's hamburger scenarios. He laid out four situations, and I want to put actual numbers on them because I think it'll be eye-opening. Scenario 2. Same burger, but skip the condiments. You drop the mayo, you're saving about 10 grams. You're still at 30 to 40 grams of fat, still likely above what he can handle in one sitting. If your daily ceiling is 40 to 50 grams, a single Whopper basically maxes you out for the day. And that's before fries, before a drink, before anything else.
In scenario 1, the generous hamburger with all the condiments, Daniel's looking at 30 to 40 grams of fat in a single meal. That's nearly his entire daily budget.
The breading absorbs oil during frying, and plenty of places use chicken thigh rather than breast because it's cheaper and tastes better. So a fried chicken sandwich with mayo can easily hit 30 grams. A grilled chicken sandwich is a different story. A grilled chicken breast patty might be only 4 to 6 grams of fat. That's a massive difference.
The preparation method is doing a lot of the work there. Fried versus grilled is not a minor distinction.
It's the single biggest variable, and this is where we can start giving Daniel some useful heuristics. When you're out and hungry, looking at a menu, you want to be thinking about fat content per serving in rough categories. Something under 10 grams of fat per serving is generally going to be safe for a meal. 10 to 15 grams is moderate, might work, might not, depends on your personal threshold. Above 15 grams in a single meal is where a lot of post-gallbladder patients start having trouble. Above 20, you're really rolling the dice.
If Daniel can train himself to think in those rough bands, under 10 is green light, 10 to 15 is yellow, above 15 is probably red. That's a usable mental framework without having to pull out a calculator.
And to Daniel's point about not wanting to be the guy at the table doing nutritional math, the goal isn't precision, it's pattern recognition. Over time, you develop an instinct for what's likely to be in which band. A grilled fish fillet with vegetables? Probably under 10 grams. A creamy pasta dish? Almost certainly above 20. You don't need the exact number to make the call.
Let's talk about the other side of this, though. Daniel mentioned he's concerned about getting enough nutrition. Protein, micronutrients, fat-soluble vitamins, while keeping fat low. Because if you just slash fat indiscriminately, you can end up with deficiencies. Vitamin A, D, E, and K are all fat-soluble. You need some dietary fat to absorb them.
This is where the 30-gram floor becomes important.
Let's build out the rest of the meal landscape, because Daniel's question is really about being out and about, hungry, and needing to make a quick decision. What are the categories of food he should be thinking about?
Your body can't synthesize linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid. Those have to come from diet. So a very low-fat diet, below 20 grams a day, sustained over time, can actually cause problems.
There's a window. The sweet spot is somewhere between about 30 grams a day at the low end, enough for nutrient absorption, and maybe 50 grams at the high end, where symptoms start becoming more likely.
Tier 1, under 10 grams of fat for a full meal. This is your safe zone. A grilled chicken breast with steamed vegetables and rice, about 6 grams. A turkey sandwich on whole wheat with mustard, no cheese, no mayo, maybe 5 grams. And the distribution matters a lot. If you eat 30 grams of fat, but you eat it all in one meal, you're probably going to have symptoms even though your daily total is technically within range. The per meal limit is the binding constraint for someone without a gallbladder. So you want to spread fat intake as evenly as possible across the day. 3 meals of 8 to 10 grams each, maybe a snack of 3 to 5 grams. A slice of cheese pizza, about 10 to 12 grams per slice, so 2 slices puts you at 20 to 24. a tuna sandwich with light mayo. Lean protein sources are your foundation. Skinless chicken breast is about 3 grams of fat per 100 grams, with about 31 grams of protein. Turkey breast is similar.
Then tier 3 is anything above 20 grams in a single meal, which for someone on a 40-gram daily budget is half your allocation.
Non-fat Greek yogurt gives you about 10 grams of protein per 100 grams with essentially zero fat. Tofu is moderate, about 4 to 5 grams of fat per 100 grams, but it's mostly unsaturated, and you get about 8 grams of protein. A steak and loaded baked potato, 50 plus grams. These are meals where you either split the portion, modify heavily, or accept that you're going to have symptoms.
The portion splitting point is interesting because Daniel mentioned it. He said smaller portions help, but when you're really hungry, you just need to eat. And he's right. There's a practicality issue. You can't always just eat a quarter of a baguette and call it lunch.
Which is why the meal frequency matters. One of the strategies that works well for post-cholecystectomy patients is eating 5 or 6 small meals instead of 3 large ones. It really is. You get the protein without the yolk fat, and the vegetables add volume and micronutrients for essentially zero fat.
Daniel's out and about. He's not sitting at home with 6 perfectly portioned Tupperware containers. He's standing in front of a food court trying to figure out what won't make him miserable.
Let's talk about the food court strategy. What's available? You've got sandwich shops, you've got Asian food, you've got pizza, you've got burger places, maybe a Mexican place. I want to walk through each.
Start with sandwiches.
A meal with some fat keeps you full longer than a completely fat-free meal. The trick is hitting that minimum effective dose, enough to trigger satiety and enable nutrient absorption, not so much that you overwhelm your bile capacity. Turkey, chicken breast, or lean roast beef. Those are your base proteins, each around 2 to 3 grams of fat per 3-ounce serving. Skip the cheese, skip the mayo, load up on vegetables. Mustard is essentially zero fat. I'm going to give some specific numbers here because they're illuminating. A standard fast food grilled chicken sandwich, no mayo, maybe mustard instead, is typically around 6 to 9 grams of fat total.
The trap to watch for?
Tuna salad and chicken salad. They're made with mayonnaise. A tuna salad sandwich from Subway has about 25 grams of fat. People think tuna, that's healthy, and they're getting half their daily fat budget in one sandwich. A medium order of fast food fries is about 15 to 19 grams of fat. That's an entire day's worth of fat for someone on a 30-gram budget, just in the side dish. And it's not satiating fat, it's fried potato. You'll be hungry again in an hour.
I love how crispy has become code for, we submerge this in oil.
It absolutely is. Crispy means fried. Crunchy means fried. Golden means fried. The restaurant industry has a whole vocabulary for, we put this in a deep fryer. And here's another option, a plain baked potato. Most fast food places don't have them anymore, but if you're at a Wendy's or a sit-down restaurant, a plain baked potato has basically zero fat. Add a small amount of sour cream, a tablespoon is about 3 grams of fat and some chives, and you've got a filling side for minimal fat cost. Or use salsa, which is fat-free and adds flavor. Pizza is tough because the fat is baked in, literally. The cheese is integral to the dish. A single slice of a large cheese pizza from Domino's is about 10 grams of fat. 2 slices is 20 grams. 3 slices is 30 grams. Mayonnaise is the big one, 10 grams of fat per tablespoon, and most sandwiches have at least a tablespoon, often more. Ranch dressing is similar, about 7 to 8 grams per tablespoon. Aioli is basically flavored mayonnaise, same deal.
Pizza is basically tier 3, almost no matter what.
Cream-based sauces like Alfredo are fat bombs. A half cup of Alfredo sauce can have 30 grams of fat.
The low-cost alternatives? And he specifically mentioned protein and micronutrients.
Barbecue sauce is low-fat, but watch the sugar. Relish and pickles add flavor without fat. Lemon juice, herbs, spices, all free. You can build a lot of flavor without adding fat if you shift your condiment strategy. They end up eating mostly carbohydrates, often refined carbs, and they're hungry all the time because fat and protein are what drive satiety. So the first principle is, when you reduce fat, you need to increase lean protein.
What does adequate protein look like in practice?
For an adult male, you're looking at about 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight as a minimum. For someone who's active, more like 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram. For a 75-kilogram person, that's 60 to 120 grams of protein per day. That's a lot of chicken breast, About 300 grams of cooked chicken breast is about 90 grams of protein and about 10 grams of fat.
You could theoretically hit your protein targets while staying well within your fat budget if you're strategic about protein sources.
A big salad with mixed greens, tomatoes, cucumbers, bell peppers, maybe some chickpeas. You can eat a huge bowl of that for maybe 5 or 6 grams of fat if you're careful with dressing. The fiber and water fill your stomach, trigger stretch receptors that signal fullness, and the fat you do include, maybe from a measured amount of olive oil or some avocado, helps with satiety duration. Cod, tilapia, haddock, all under 1 gram of fat, about 20 grams of protein.
The ones to be careful with.
A bean and vegetable soup with a piece of whole grain bread, very filling, very low fat. A poke bowl with rice, edamame, cucumber, seaweed, and lean fish like tuna or salmon in a small portion. You're getting the omega-3s from the fish without overloading on fat because the portion is controlled.
Let's talk about the salmon point, because fatty fish are interesting here. Salmon is high in fat, but it's the kind of fat that's beneficial, omega-3s. If you're on a fat-restricted diet, do you just avoid salmon, or is there a way to include it?
You include it, but you control the portion. A 3-ounce serving of wild salmon has about 5 to 7 grams of fat. Farm salmon is higher, maybe 10 to 12 grams for the same portion. So a 3-ounce piece of wild salmon with vegetables and maybe a half cup of quinoa is a very manageable meal, maybe 9 to 10 grams of fat total. You're getting high-quality protein, omega-3s, and the fat is doing useful work. The key is the portion size. A restaurant serving of salmon is often 6 to 8 ounces, which doubles the fat. So at a restaurant, you either eat half and take the rest home, or you specifically ask for a smaller portion.
That's a useful restaurant strategy in general, immediately boxing half the meal before you start eating. It controls both portion and fat without requiring you to calculate anything in the moment.
It addresses Daniel's point about being really hungry. If you're starving and there's a full plate in front of you, you're going to eat the whole thing. That's just human. But if you box half immediately, you set a boundary. You eat your half, you wait 15 minutes, and if you're still hungry, you can always eat more. But usually by the time the satiety signals kick in, you realize you're fine.
Let's get into some specific meal examples across a day.
I think for someone with significant post-cholecystectomy symptoms, 40 grams is a good target that allows for some flexibility. Let me build out a sample day. For breakfast, you could do a bowl of oatmeal made with water or low-fat milk. That's about 2 to 3 grams of fat, with some berries and maybe a tablespoon of ground flaxseed, which adds about 3 grams of fiber and a bit over 3 grams of fat, mostly the good kind.
Let's talk about those fat bombs, the things that seem innocent but pack 20 plus grams of fat.
Pastries and baked goods are number 1 on my list. A croissant is about 12 grams of fat. A muffin from a coffee shop, 15 to 20 grams. A scone, 15 grams. 2 egg whites scrambled with vegetables, 1 slice of whole grain toast with a thin spread of avocado, maybe a quarter of an avocado mashed on there. That's about 6 to 7 grams of fat total. The avocado gives you the creamy mouthfeel and the healthy fats for absorption. The egg whites give you protein, the vegetables give you volume. The grilled chicken sandwich we talked about, 6 to 9 grams of fat, side of baby carrots or an apple, maybe a non-fat Greek yogurt for additional protein. That's a lunch around 8 to 10 grams of fat. A piece of white fish, cod or tilapia, baked with herbs and lemon, about 1 gram of fat. A cup of roasted vegetables with a teaspoon of olive oil, about 5 grams of fat. Half a cup of brown rice, about 1 gram of fat.
Nuts and seeds.
You've got room for a snack, maybe a small handful of almonds, about 7 grams of fat, which brings you to around 30 to 32 grams for the day. That's a well-balanced, nutrient-dense day with plenty of protein, fiber, and micronutrients, and the fat is distributed across meals in manageable amounts.
That's helpful as a template. But I want to acknowledge something Daniel said that I think is important. He didn't used to think about nutrition at all before the surgery. He just ate food. And now he's having to become literate in a whole domain he never wanted to engage with. That's a real psychological shift.
It's a huge adjustment. The people who struggle most are often the ones who never had to think about food before. They had good metabolisms, they ate whatever, and then suddenly they have this constraint and it feels like a punishment. The reframe that helps is to think of it not as restriction, but as learning a new skill. You're developing food literacy. Once you internalize the rough patterns, grilled beets fried, mustard beets mayo, vegetables fill the plate, protein comes lean, you stop having to think about it consciously. It becomes automatic.
There's also a social dimension here that Daniel didn't explicitly mention, but I know from other conversations is real.
Fat-soluble vitamins. A, D, E, and K require dietary fat for absorption, but the amount required is surprisingly small. That's a real challenge. My suggestion is to develop a few go-to orders at common restaurant types that you know work, so you don't have to study the menu every time. At a diner, grilled chicken breast with steamed vegetables and a baked potato, butter and sour cream on the side so you control the amount. At an Italian place, pasta with marinara rather than cream sauce or a grilled fish dish.
3 to 5 grams is nothing. That's a drizzle of oil.
At a sushi place, sashimi is very low fat. Rolls with cucumber and lean fish, avoid the tempura rolls and anything with cream cheese or spicy mayo. The real risk is for people on extremely low-fat diets, under 10 grams per day, which is essentially a rice and vegetables diet with no added fat at all. That's where you start seeing deficiencies.
A drizzle of spicy mayo on a sushi roll can add 5 to 8 grams of fat. And it's so integrated into the roll that you don't even register it as a separate condiment.
That's true of a lot of restaurant food. The fat is hidden. Butter in the vegetables, oil in the marinade, cheese melted into things where you can't see it. This is where cooking at home gives you a huge advantage, because you know exactly what's going into your food. But Daniel's question was specifically about being out and hungry, and for that, you need heuristics. So meeting the essential fatty acid requirement on a 40-gram fat diet is not difficult. It becomes a concern below about 15 grams of total fat per day.
The sweet spot really is that 20 to 40-gram range. Below 20, you start risking deficiencies. Above 40 or 50, you start triggering symptoms. And within that window, you can get adequate protein, adequate micronutrients, and adequate essential fatty acids.
Eating every 3 to 4 hours with each meal or snack staying within that 8 to 12 gram fat window is generally much better tolerated than 2 or 3 large meals. Constantly scanning menus, mentally calculating fat grams, worrying about whether a meal is going to make you uncomfortable, that's a cognitive load that people without this condition don't appreciate.
There's a term for this in the eating disorder literature, cognitive dietary restraint. It's the mental energy spent constantly monitoring and restricting food intake, and even when it's medically necessary, it's exhausting.
Eating something, even something small and low fat, gives the bile something to work on and may actually reduce irritation. So regular small meals serve a double purpose. They prevent fat overload, and they may reduce the contact time between bile acids and the intestinal wall.
That's a good segue into something Daniel hinted at, the emerging evidence that this constant bile drip isn't as benign as was long assumed. What's the current thinking there?
The traditional view was exactly what Daniel described. The liver keeps making bile. It just drips continuously into the duodenum, no harm done. But over the last decade or so, there's been increasing recognition of something called bile acid malabsorption, or bile acid diarrhea, which affects a subset of post-cholecystectomy patients. The bile acids reach the colon, where they stimulate water secretion and increase motility. Beyond that, there's research looking at whether chronic bile acid exposure promotes inflammation in the intestinal lining and potentially increases the risk of certain conditions over the long term. The evidence isn't settled, but it's enough that the medical community is taking it more seriously than they used to. Grilled salmon with roasted vegetables and quinoa. About 18 grams of fat, mostly from the salmon. That's a healthy meal, but it's using a third to half of your daily fat budget. Substitute cod or tilapia and you drop to about 6 grams. And the practical implication is that managing fat intake isn't just about avoiding acute discomfort. It may also be about reducing long-term risk. That's speculative. We need more research. But it's a reasonable precautionary principle.
Let's circle back to something practical. Daniel asked about nutritional labels and how to read them for this purpose. When you're looking at a packaged food, what are you actually scanning for?
The fat line is obviously the main thing, but you need to look at 3 numbers: total fat per serving, saturated fat, and serving size. Serving size is the one people miss. Something might say 4 grams of fat per serving, but if the serving size is unrealistically small, like 6 crackers, and you're going to eat 30 crackers, you need to multiply.
Let's talk about eating out specifically, because Daniel framed his question around being out and about. What are the safest restaurant cuisines for low-fat eating?
Japanese is probably the best if you stick to sushi and sashimi. A typical sushi meal, miso soup, edamame, a tuna roll, and some sashimi, is going to be under 15 grams of fat. Avoid tempura, avoid rolls with cream cheese or spicy mayo. Vietnamese pho is excellent. The broth is essentially fat-free, the rice noodles are fat-free, and you're getting lean protein from the beef or chicken. A large bowl of pho is maybe 8 to 10 grams of fat.
What about Middle Eastern?
The percentage is almost useless for post-cholecystectomy patients. You're better off ignoring it and just working with the absolute grams. But grilled chicken shawarma with tabbouleh and pickled vegetables, no excessive tahini. You're around 12 to 15 grams. The pita bread itself is low fat. The danger is the fried items and the heavy sauces. The ingredient list tells you where the fat is coming from. If the first few ingredients include oils, butter, cream, cheese, or eggs, the fat is going to be substantial. Also watch for things like partially hydrogenated oils. Those are trans fats, which you want to avoid regardless, but they're also a marker of highly processed food that's likely to be high in total fat.
The pattern across cuisines is consistent. Grilled proteins, broth-based or tomato-based sauces, steamed or boiled grains, and vegetables prepared without excessive oil.
That's actually a pretty good diet by any standard. It's not just a medically necessary diet, it's a healthy diet. Low in saturated fat, high in lean protein, plenty of fiber from vegetables and whole grains.
Is there a meaningful difference between chains, or is it all pretty similar?
There are real differences. A grilled chicken sandwich from Chick-fil-A is about 6 grams of fat. The same style sandwich from McDonald's, the McChicken, which is fried, is about 17 grams of fat. Burger King's original chicken sandwich is fried and around 18 grams, so even within the fast food category, the range is wide. The grilled options, where they exist, are dramatically lower.
How would someone figure out their personal threshold?
It requires some deliberate experimentation, which is not fun when the consequence of getting it wrong is gastrointestinal distress. Then you look for the least bad fried option and you modify it. A fried chicken sandwich with the top bun removed, no mayo, extra lettuce and tomato. You've probably cut 5 to 8 grams of fat just by stripping the condiments and reducing the bread.
It's probably not just total grams. It's grams per meal, right? Because the bile trickle can handle small amounts continuously, but a big bolus of fat in one meal overwhelms it.
Or you go with a side salad and a plain hamburger patty. Just a patty, no bun, no cheese, which is about 8 to 10 grams of fat and surprisingly filling. The bile production rate just can't ramp up fast enough without a gallbladder.
The advice is not just keep total fat under 40 grams. It's don't eat more than about 15 grams of fat in any single meal.
And that's a much harder constraint when you're eating out, because restaurant meals are not designed with a 15-gram fat ceiling. A typical restaurant entree is 20 to 40 grams of fat. A single slice of regular cheese pizza from a typical chain is about 10 to 12 grams of fat. That's one slice. Most people eat two or three, so a two-slice meal is already over 20 grams, three slices is over 30.
Let's put together a practical framework. If you're someone like Daniel, post-cholecystectomy, trying to manage symptoms while still eating out and having a life, what's the daily strategy?
But even then, two slices puts you at the upper end of the per-meal threshold. 2. Keep individual meals under 15 grams of fat, which means most restaurant meals need modification. 3. Prioritize lean proteins at every meal. Chicken breast, turkey, fish, egg whites, non-fat dairy, to maintain satiety and muscle mass. And that's a useful general principle.
The fifth principle, which you didn't say but I think is implied, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. If you're out with friends and you eat a meal that's 30 grams of fat, you haven't failed. You just use more of your budget than usual. Tomorrow is another day.
That's important. The psychological burden we talked about, part of it comes from perfectionism. The feeling that if you can't eat perfectly, you failed. But this is a chronic condition. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Some days you'll be at 20 grams, some days you'll be at 50. The goal is to keep the average in a range where you're not constantly symptomatic and not nutritionally deficient.
And then a set of heuristics. Grilled over fried, mustard over mayo, vegetables for volume, lean proteins as the foundation, strategic fat for satiety, and nutrient absorption. That's a sign that you're taking it seriously.
prioritize unsaturated fats, olive oil, avocado, nuts, seeds, fatty fish, over saturated fats when you do include fat. The bile doesn't care whether the fat is saturated or unsaturated, but your cardiovascular system does. And post-cholecystectomy patients sometimes see changes in their lipid profiles, so the quality of the fat you do eat becomes more important.
The fat budget is limited, so make the grams count.
If you've only got 40 grams of fat to spend in a day, spend them on olive oil, almonds, and salmon rather than butter, cheese, and processed snacks. You'll get more nutritional value per gram.
Let's address the micronutrient concern Daniel raised. He's worried that cutting fat will mean missing out on fat-soluble vitamins. Is that a legitimate concern at the 30 to 50 gram level, or is that more of an issue at very low fat intakes?
The bacterium Deinococcus radiodurans was first isolated in the 1940s from canned meat that had spoiled, despite being sterilized with radiation. Its name literally means strange berry that withstands radiation.
A bacterium named after a strange berry? I don't know what to do with that.
The concern is more relevant for people on extremely low-fat diets, under 20 grams a day, or for people who take their fat-soluble vitamin supplements on an empty stomach with no fat at all.
So, to wrap this up, Daniel, you've been chipping away at this puzzle for 7 years, and I think the answer is both simpler and more nuanced than you might expect. What about fiber? Daniel mentioned bloating as his main symptom. Fiber can also cause bloating in some people. Is there a tension between the advice to eat more vegetables for volume and the potential for fiber-related bloating? You can meet all your nutritional needs within that window. Protein, micronutrients, essential fatty acids, if you're thoughtful about food choices. And the real-world strategy comes down to a few reliable heuristics. Grilled over fried, mustard over mayo, tomato sauce over cream sauce, and always check what's hiding in the dressing.
Cooked vegetables are often better tolerated than raw. Soluble fiber from oats and legumes may be gentler than insoluble fiber from wheat bran and raw greens. It's an N-of-1 experiment. You have to figure out your own tolerance. Anything described as crispy, creamy, or fried is going to be a significant fat hit. And when in doubt, eat half and take the rest home.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.